This is a fly. This is folly.
With style.
Strange little man.
Welcome to the fourth episode of Falling with Style. I'm Doug.
And I'm Derek.
And this is an ongoing Pixar movie marathon podcast. Each episode is dedicated to exactly one movie in the Pixar Animation Studios canon. Today we're talking about Monsters, Inc., Pixar's first film not directed by John Lasseter, and the second of the four lunch meeting movies. Monsters, Inc. was directed by Pete Docter in his directorial debut, developed and written by a whole bunch of folks, and released widely on November 2nd, 2001, just shy of 2 years after Toy Story 2. And prior to this conversation, Doug's seen it probably a couple dozen times, and Derek has seen it, I don't know how many times.
I think one time.
Whoa! Oh, okay.
Shocker, I know.
One time. Okay, well, that's exciting.
Because I didn't see it in theaters for sure. I think I just watched it on TV once and then never again, especially based on my lack of memory for anything that happened in this entire movie.
Okay, I'm really excited about that. This is actually the first Pixar movie I did see in theaters, I'm pretty sure. And I think I probably saw it maybe like well after it was out for like a month or so.
Yeah.
Because there it has like alternate credits that I definitely remember. So I'm pretty sure I must have seen it after the first version of the credits. So
yeah.
But that's exciting. I'm glad that this is one you've only seen once because it means there's probably lots of surprises for you.
Yeah. It's funny because I couldn't tell you why. I don't know why I wasn't in theaters for this or why, you know, my parents didn't take me. I guess we were like 11 or 12 at this point. So maybe I'm like, I guess I wasn't super as super excited about them at that age.
Pixar's for babies, Dad.
I wasn't like that as a kid though. And I had a little sister who would have been right in the right age for them. So yeah, I really truly don't know why we weren't like a Pixar family during this period. Cause we're hitting a run where, even though these are classic movies, they're ones that I either didn't see in theaters, haven't watched very often, or like haven't seen at all for like a big chunk of them that are coming up right now, including this one. And I couldn't tell you why, because Monsters, Inc., like the concept is like right up my alley. So I really have no idea.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that makes me all the more excited to dive into this one because I feel like for a couple reasons, I mean, like conceptually, thematically, but also just like this specific story of this movie, I'm very excited to get your takes then if it's relatively fresh for you.
Sure.
So that is pretty cool. I will say, like, production wise, I mean, I guess I'll shout out some folks real quick. The story for this one and really the concept overall for this one is Pete Docter's. But the story is by Pete Docter, Jill Colton, Jeff Pigeon, and Ralph Eggleston. The screenplay was written by Andrew Stanton and Dan Gerson. Andrew Stanton is a name we're going to hear over and over and over again.
Sure.
If it's not already familiar.
Mm-hmm. Did Pete Docter do other Pixar movies, or is this sort of like, I mean, other that are outside of the Monsters, Inc. like universe?
Yeah. Yeah. Pete Docter has done, I think, 4 Pixar movies.
Okay.
Actually, I don't think he's the one who directed Monsters University.
Oh, interesting.
Interestingly enough.
Definitely haven't seen that either, so no knowledge of it whatsoever.
We'll get to it. He's I'm pretty sure he's directed about 4. It's interesting with these Pixar folks because some of them go on to be directors, and I don't know if they necessarily ever expected to, because ultimately they're part of the brain trust, or they are, you know, in a supervisory role, or they are, you know, they're part of like story teams or whatever the case may be. And Pete Docter has been at Pixar forever. He's still at Pixar. I think he's the...
Okay.
He is... When John Lasseter left, his position was split, I think, in 2 directions. And I believe Pete Docter is one of those 2 people.
Oh, okay. Wow. The only reason I asked is because this movie just like felt a little different to me than the past few Pixar movies in a way that it's sort of like, is this like a new voice that's coming in that hasn't, you know, that maybe like came in for this one and hasn't really done other ones, but that could also just be like I have nostalgia for other Pixar movies and not really for this. And so I'm just seeing it a little bit differently. I don't know. But that's interesting that he's like been a part of it the whole time. So strike that theory.
it still is a different person. I mean, it's not directed by John Lasseter. It's not John Lasseter's idea. And Toy Story very much is John Lasseter's idea and his vision. And then when we revisit Cars, it'll be the same thing. We're like,
gotcha.
That's very much John Lasseter's thing. But we have finally hit a point where, you know, this movie is not, it's not his, it's not John Lasseter's idea. It's the first movie made at like the new Pixar Animation Studios with like the intentionally new sort of climate and work ethic as a result of the disaster that was Toy Story 2, you know, like destroying right. people's lives. So I think there's a lot of reasons to, I think there's a lot of reasons why it probably feels different. And I think there's enough variables that it might be hard to figure out exactly why. But I think there's lots of things you can point to.
Sure, definitely.
Pete Docter is the chief creative officer.
Oh, okay.
At Pixar right now. So okay. I wanted to make sure I got his title in there. So the big thing with Monsters production-wise that I personally find the most fascinating when you look at like the whole canon of Pixar is with the early movies, you can always tell that there is one or two things that they are trying to tackle through that movie. And Monsters, the big thing, and this is the thing they'll talk about over and over. I mean, you can go to Pixar's website and watch like little shorts about this, is hair and fur.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And that's, yeah, and it's front and center. But I think the thing about hair and fur in this movie is that Pixar was trying to make it the most realistic fur you'd ever seen animated this way, right? I mean, they animated hair in Toy Story, but it looked like garbage.
yep.
There were, you know, the polar bear commercials, I think, for Coca-Cola, and technically they had like fur and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But what Pixar wanted to do was make this big furry creature that had realistic looking and moving hair. And that's really kind of like the big achievement that they come up with Sully, you know, like he's a big fur covered monster with over 2 million individual hairs that all move, well, not technically independently of each other, but kind of independently of each other. And the thing that really set them apart was figuring out how to make each one of those hairs, each one of those millions of hairs, cast a shadow that affected all the other hair.
Oh, that makes sense.
Which is what the problem was up to this point.
Yeah, though, you know, that makes a lot of sense. I didn't think about that because that was one thing I did sort of notice because I knew that this was their big fur movie, right? Like I knew that was like the innovation. So I was paying a lot of attention to it. And I think it looks good. I think it holds up great. But one thing I did notice about it is that like I think it almost felt like more like effort was put into lighting characters with fur than it was like lighting anything else in the movie.
Yeah. No, I think you're totally right. You know, I said on a previous episode that I think Monsters, Inc. is probably the Pixar movie that ages the worst. It ages really well, but in comparison to other early Pixar movies, I think because certain elements of it are such massive achievements, other elements of it kind of show a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think you nailed one of them, right? Like, there are shots, I think, that are probably specifically, if not conceived to do this, at least are shot the way that they are or animated the way that they are to specifically show off the way that Sully's fur moves.
Yep.
I'm thinking of pretty much the entire scene in like the snow with the wind and the snow and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the lighting and everything really just shows off Sully's fur. But then you do see other moments where you're like, is there even lighting on this? Or is that literally just how you colored it to sort of like fake lighting?
Right.
And then there are some scenes that are very obviously, and I think they end up looking good in spite of this, but there are some scenes that I'm sure we'll talk about at some point that are actually like more painted than they are constructed.
Interesting.
And I think that's sort of why. And I think there are certain scenes that are animated so well and so naturally that other scenes really end up looking animatronic in comparison.
I can definitely see that. There's certain like monsters I'll see that look like kind of out of date for like where
yeah.
Pixar is at. And honestly, like a lot of like the settings and backgrounds, like they don't look bad, but they're also, a lot of them are surprisingly, considering this is a whole like monster world that's been constructed, a lot of like the backgrounds and sets that they're on are kind of boring. Like there's some places that are like decorated nicely and lit nicely. Other ones that just look kind of flat and don't really have much to them. And then it's just like, I definitely got that sense that there was like skimping on some of that stuff.
Yeah, and I think part of it is probably like a vision for the environment and like certain color stories and whatnot that I just don't think age very well. But it's interesting. I can't wait until we get to Monsters University, especially because you haven't seen it, because that movie really played with lighting in a way that Pixar hadn't before. So it's like funny that Monsters, Inc. was so reliant on lighting to really sell their fur. And then when they went back to that same franchise or that same property, they basically said like, hey, what could we do even better? And I have to imagine that when they went back to, you know, watch and examine Monsters, Inc., I don't know this is speculation, I'll try to find out, but I have to imagine when they went back to Monsters, Inc., they said, this movie's, like, kind of cold. Like, its lighting is frequently very cold,
yeah.
And I think it's because they're in a factory, I think it's on purpose, but, you know, just briefly revisiting Monsters University when I was watching Monsters, Inc., they definitely warmed everything way up.
Yeah.
way up.
Because you can be in a factory
yes.
and still make it a fun factory. Like, it doesn't have to
yes.
be as, like, sterile as it is in this movie. And it's just, like, you can have fun, like, little chase sequences down hallways, and the hallway doesn't have to be, like, blank because it's an office
yeah.
in a factory. Like, it's still, like, a magical, whimsical movie within a world full of monsters. Like, come on, it's fine.
Yes.
Make it silly. It's cool.
Totally, totally. I do think they're probably, you know, this is still early Pixar, so a lot of their, you know, we've talked about this, a lot of their concepts are like, what if toys were alive? What if monsters had their own world? What if bugs could talk? What if cars were alive? Like, is that sort of like joke of like, what if clothes were alive?
Yeah.
Pixar. This is still sort of in that realm, but I do think one thing that's a little bit different than the three we've talked about so far is Toy Story takes place in our world. It just has a fantastical element, right?
Mm-hmm.
A Bug's Life technically takes place in our world. It's just zoomed in dramatically. This kind of actually creates a world separate from our own and explores that relationship, which they do kind of in Toy Story, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of its own world. They do kind of in A Bug's Life. It's sort of its own world. But with Monsters, Inc., like, our world exists in that universe, but then also the monster world. So I think some of the design stuff they did was like to try to make it familiar because it's where we're spending all of our time, but also monster-y to a degree. And I think it shines better when you're out of the factory.
I also wonder, yeah, that's true for sure. I also wonder if maybe like the idea was sort of like the contrast between like, look at these silly, wacky monsters, but in a very, like, typical, boring, real-world environment. Like, isn't that an interesting
yeah.
contrast? Which I can sort of see, like, in concept, but it doesn't really help the movie at all. Like, it doesn't really come through enough to really liven anything up, you know?
I do think that's probably a big part of it, because I know that earlier parts, like, earlier versions of the movie had Sullivan being more of, like a timid guy in a workplace, or like
mm-hmm.
more of an office worker, or like a peon. Like, it went through so many different versions. It does sound like they probably wanted to explore the idea of like, they're monsters, but they're just like us.
Yeah.
And monsters hate their jobs too sometimes. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that was probably a big part of it, but it ends up resulting in comparison to other Pixar movies, a pretty cold, uninteresting environment given
yeah.
they spend most of their time in the factory.
Definitely.
One thing that this movie sort of had to overcome that we will talk about at least one other time with Pixar in probably a bigger way is this idea that, like, we have a cool concept, but it's a family movie, so how do we make it work for kids in the audience? Because an early version of this story had James Sullivan, or at the time, I guess, Johnson, he was called, just like average Joe Schmo Johnson,
mm-hmm.
trying to become like a good scarer, right? Like that was sort of the concept. And I think one of the things they had to overcome was this idea that like, well, wait a second, how do we make a movie where our good guys are trying their hardest to scare kids? You know, like, doesn't that make them scary, or doesn't
yeah.
that make them potentially actually bad guy monsters as opposed to like cute fluffy monsters. And this is the first time I think they really sort of encountered that specific problem. I mean, Woody was a jerk, mm-hmm. but this conceptually was sort of a challenge. And I think where they landed makes a lot of sense. And I think they sort of realized, well, what if we make Sully the top scarer, then the stakes aren't, can I be the best scarer? He already is. So it becomes more of a loss thing, or like the conflict is more about loss or like losing that position than it becomes like, how do I get to a point where I'm the scariest?
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. That does. So you're going to hate that I'm about to say this right now, but I kind of think that I have like two kind of hot takes about the movie.
Oh, I can't wait. I think this is one of the things that's so important or exciting or both about getting your opinions on some of these things, especially yeah. when they're movies that you're sort of only becoming familiar with in this way
yeah.
now.
I'll get to one of them later, but the other one I think is sort of related to like what you're describing with sort of figuring out Sully's role in the movie and like kind of how yeah. they were figuring it out. Because I sort of think my first one that I thought of very early on is that, and I think might have been a thing that maybe not super interested in the movie when it came out when I was a kid, is that the concept of the movie is that the monsters in your closet are real and they are trying to scare you to allow their world to exist, essentially, because they thrive on your screams or their electricity thrives on your screams. Right. And then the arc of the movie is sort of like monsters realizing that they don't actually have to be scary because and in fact, they aren't necessarily like created just to be scary. Like they can also be funny and make kids laugh because all monsters are different and have different personalities and everything. Right. I sort of feel like I don't love the super cartoony designs of all of the monsters. And I think Sully, I get why you would want to make your protagonist, even though he's a monster, more like a Jim Henson Muppet kind of monster where they're like cute and fuzzy. Like they're yeah. kind of monsters in name only. But I sort of feel like the movie would be more effective if they were kind of like designed to initially, if you're just looking at an image of them, to be like a little more scary, not necessarily like grotesque. And I know they can't go super scary because you want kids to not be so scared to see the movie, but like at least look a little more, like have a little more edge to them. So then I feel like it makes the arc of like realizing that, no, they actually aren't like scary normally, even if they look like they are, they're actually like nice people and can be funny. I feel like that would make that more effective rather than like them starting off all kind of looking either cute and cuddly or like silly and cartoony. And I feel like that for me is sort of like an instant, not turn off for the movie, because I still really like this movie. I need to make that clear. Still like it a lot. Still really enjoyed it. But I sort of think that it just would have been a little bit better and thematically would have been stronger if the designs weren't so cute and or silly. You know what I mean?
I mean, I think you have a good point. Like, I don't necessarily disagree with anything you're saying. I imagine that for them, the movie wasn't ever supposed to be super focused on scary monsters, and that sort of like the conflict is the energy crisis, and that sort of like sets off why the, because there is like an energy crisis. They talk about like rollouts and kids aren't, or not rollouts, they talk about like rolling blackouts because like kids aren't as easily scared anymore. And so like for them, it's a matter of like, oh no, are we going to be able to run our cities or whatever? And that sort of motivates the monsters that are supposed to be scary or bad guys to do the bad things they're doing that get in the way of what Mike and Sully are trying to do.
Yeah.
So I think the scaring part is largely like setup and concept. And I think I'm imagining that they probably are like, well, we don't want scary monsters because that makes it harder for us to. And this is basic, and Pixar can do what I'm saying they weren't doing. But I feel like they probably were like, well, we want to make sure the bad guys are very obviously bad. So
yeah.
the only scary ones are going to be Randall and Mr. Waters, like Water Noose, right? Like
right.
they're obviously scary and obviously the bad guys. I don't think this movie's like trying to be like nuanced in that way. And so I feel like they
yeah.
probably didn't even... For them, it probably wasn't even a factor of, like, should the monsters actually be scary?
Yeah, I think...
If you look at, like, concept art, they definitely were a lot more grotesque and weird early on. And I think over time, they just got cuter and cuter.
Yeah, and I think, like, I need to make it clear, because I understand why they went in that direction. It's really more, like, I think that for the types of, I think Pixar is capable of making like kind of challenging kids movies. And I think that would have been a challenging thing to do, but I think they could have pulled it off. So it's more like, I get why they didn't do that. It does make more logical sense to make your protagonists cute and silly for the most part, especially if you want little kids to see movies and not be scared by them. Right. So I get that. But I think it would have been more effective ultimately, but I think you're right. Like the kind of crux of it, the scaring aspect is just more kind of the background and the concept and the plot device more than anything else. Like it's not really,
it's like world building more than it is like the actual conflict.
Yeah. And I think that's, and I brought it up when you're talking about Sully and sort of changing his character, because I think that's probably part of it. Because if you're figuring out what his arc's going to be and everything, if you're focusing a lot less on the scare aspect of the world and just making that just kind of a part of the plot rather than really the larger theme of the movie, like, or at least less focus as a larger theme of the movie, then yeah, you just make Sully like a cute and cuddly creature. Because I do love his design, like in a vacuum as it is, and I still enjoy watching him, you know. So yeah, I get it. It just would have been, it would have been interesting to see Pixar tackle it differently if they had, you know, the capabilities to do so.
And I think they could, totally. And I think they would had this movie been later in the canon. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because if you think of movies like Inside Out, like that's a complicated movie. You know what I mean? If you look at movies like Brave, like that's a complicated movie. This one's not complicated. And actually, you know, it's hard to find bad reviews for this movie. It's hard to find bad reviews for a lot of Pixar movies. But I did find one early on, like as it was just being released, that did sort of criticize it for being too flat and predictable. And I don't think it was trying to not be flat or predictable. You know what I mean? I think it was doing a very straightforward thing. But that doesn't necessarily make you immune from the criticism that it is flat and predictable, you know, if that's what you're trying to avoid.
Yeah, I think I struggled with that a bit, because if it had been like before Toy Story 2 even, I think I might have seen it differently. But having seen the great strides in terms of like narrative and characterization that they made in Toy Story 2, to come to this movie where like I like the villains kind of, but I also feel like the villains are kind of boring and fairly straightforward. Whereas every villain preceding this was at least interesting, you know, like I like Waternoose's cool, like spider crustacean design.
Oh,
I like
my gosh, his design is so good.
His design is really cool, but he's also like kind of, you know, they pull the same surprise twist villain thing with him that they sort of did with Stinky Pete in the movie before it. And then Randall, like I like his camouflaging stuff that he does. They do some fun stuff with that. But other than that, it's like, I don't know what his motivation is. He's just evil. I guess. Is Steve Buscemi being evil? Okay. Like, it's just like, if this wasn't a Pixar movie and it wasn't a Pixar movie that came right after Toy Story 2, I think my expectations would have been different. It just felt like a weird step down in some ways from Toy Story 2.
Yeah. I don't think you're alone in that. I think you're more worried about it being like an incendiary take than it actually is an incendiary take. I think it's a more critical take, but I think this movie's beloved. But if you look at like lists where they're sort of critically ranking Pixar movies, Monsters, Inc. really shouldn't be in the top tier. You know what I mean? Like, and it doesn't always end up there. And it's not a Pixar universe that I think critically stacks up against some of the other ones.
Sure.
But it's beloved and it's cute, and I think that's why people like it.
Oh, and just it's very cute and it's very fun. I still was crying in the last shot of it. So like it's effective in its own way, you know. It's just it definitely is. It's different than what we've seen in ways that I wasn't really vibing with as much as I
wanted. No, I think that's all. I think that's all very legit. You know what I would love to see them do? I would love to see them develop Pete Docter's like very, very original idea for what a Monsters movie would look like, because his very original idea that I think they could pull off now but wouldn't have been able to at the time this was made because of what Pixar's brand was at the time, because I do think it's changed. His idea was that monsters are real and that they live in your closet and all this sort of stuff. But there's this guy who works sort of like a regular job, and he suddenly starts seeing the monsters that tormented him as a kid. And it would turn out that each one of those monsters sort of represented a fear of his that he had never tackled or confronted.
Whoa.
And I actually think, I feel like that idea is exactly the type of movie you would expect now from Pixar. When you look at Inside Out, when you look at WALL-E, when you look at Brave, when you look at these ones that like tackle complex human emotion, that I think fits more the now brand of Pixar than it did the then brand of Pixar. But this movie we're talking about is like so quintessentially early Pixar that I feel like it, I don't even know if that movie, as good as it might have been, would have caught anybody. You know what I mean?
Like,
Because so much of these early movies, I do think, rely on that that early Pixar magic of like fantasy worlds.
I agree. I don't think, as much as I want to see that, it wouldn't have worked this early. Yeah. And I think that might have been a little too heady for audiences at the time. Not that audiences were like stupid in 2001, but like if you're coming to see, if you're taking your kids to a movie in 2001, the expectations are different.
Totally.
You know what you're getting into when you're taking your kids to a Pixar movie now, or even like, you know, if you're taking your kids to Into the Spider-Verse, you're expecting that to be a little denser than what you would have expected in 2001, just because kids' movies have changed.
Yeah, totally. So, okay, we haven't talked about the cast yet. You want to talk about the cast a little bit before we dive deeply into the story? We get John Goodman as Sully, which I think is incredible.
Love it. He's great.
I don't think that was their first choice. I'm glad that they got not their first choice, because I think Pete Docter really wanted Bill Murray, but like couldn't get a hold of him because he's Bill Murray.
I wouldn't have liked that. I like Bill Murray in certain things, but I think he would not have had the warmth that you needed for this at all.
Yeah. John Goodman has such an incredible... I could listen to John Goodman say anything at all. And it a big part of that is that he has a really warm presence, and I think that works so well for Sully, especially.
Mm-hmm.
I also don't think Bill Murray and Billy Crystal would have, like, worked as well as these two do.
I agree.
They're not enough of an odd couple to make what they do with Sully and Mike work. And I don't know, part of that might be that Mike Wazowski was like a pretty late addition to like make things make more sense.
I was wondering, because that's my other hot take about this movie involves Mike Wazowski, but we'll get to that later.
Oh, well, this might be where we differ a little bit more then if you have a hot take about Mike. But yeah, Mike was added a little bit later because they initially, it was supposed to be this sort of like timid sort of monster who ends up somehow being like odd couple buddy movie matched up with like a much older version of Boo, who is sort of this like toughened, like more imposing presence. Imposing is a little strong because I think she was still like 7 years old, but that was sort of the initial thing. And I think the more they developed Sully and sort of realized like it wouldn't work to have him aspire to be scary, they needed somebody to not be that and who he also could confide in, the more they sort of like developed the problem of Boo being there.
Yeah.
So I think Mike initially was there, in addition to being like funny, which is like Mike's whole thing, right?
Sure.
In addition to that, I think he was placed in there so that Sully would have somebody to work with, but also kind of be like, they had a shared motivation but had different attitudes about it, and I think that was something that they felt like they needed to like flesh things out, I guess.
Yeah, his role in the story makes a lot of sense for sure.
Yeah. I think Billy Crystal does a good job. I'm glad we got him here and not as Buzz Lightyear.
Oh God. He would have been terrible as Buzz Lightyear. I mean, Tim Allen isn't my favorite person by a long shot now, but performance-wise, perfect for Buzz Lightyear.
Yeah.
Yeah, Billy Crystal, he's kind of just playing himself as Mike Wazowski, and it works because it's a very particular kind of energy. Totally.
I think Mike Wazowski is one of the most consistently animated things in this whole movie.
Oh,
to talk
for
specifically
sure
about animation, I think he's one of the most consistently done. I think it's very rare that he ever feels animatronic, and I'm sure part of that is like the majority of his face is just an eye.
Mm-hmm.
But he's actually really smooth and consistent in a way that I don't even think Sully is.
No, I totally agree. I think they do really good stuff with him. I love that like his eyeball is always moving, like even when he's standing still. Like that's an obvious thing, but I remember noticing that when I was a kid, just seeing the trailers, I was just like, that's really realistic. Because any cartoon that I would have watched otherwise would have, if someone's standing still and staring, they would just be standing still. But it's like, no, eyes are always moving, so his eye is moving. So he looks, they do great stuff with him.
Yeah, well, and with his eye being so massive, like it becomes that much more obvious. On the topic of eyes, like I was actually kind of surprised. I wanted to pay really close attention to Sully's face, because I think Sully's face is one of the things I always remember not aging super duper well. And I still think I kind of stand by that a little bit. I think in this movie, his face looks a little bit more like Mr. Potato-y head stuck on than it does in future iterations.
Yeah.
Not always. I mean, there are some scenes like when he thinks Boo is being crushed. Incredible. incredible. That all that stuff is animated so incredibly. Mm-hmm. But then there are other times where it kind of just looks like he has like Muppet stuck on eyes. And I was surprised by that because eyes are typically a thing that Pixar pays so much attention to. And so it was like weird. And one of the reasons I think this movie hasn't aged super well is a lot of the eyes, I think, feel a bit Muppety or they feel a bit stuck on, even outside the monster that literally has eyes stuck onto his face.
Yeah, and there's tons of eyes in this movie. There's eyes.
So many eyes.
All over the place. I like it. I like that they did that.
Oh, yeah.
That was a clever thing to do for your monster world. If they're not going to be creepy monsters, at least have lots of eyes floating around, because there's a creepiness aspect to that that works.
It's really ambitious. I mean, this is the most fleshy bodies they've had in any movie ever. Mm-hmm. They've had no fleshy bodies aside from like Andy, who looks awful. You know what I mean? So this is the most fleshy bodies they have. And I think given that, they do a good job, but it still shows a little bit.
It does,
Boo is actually voiced by Mary Gibbs, which, fun fact, is Boo's real name in the movie too. We don't really get that outside of seeing her name on one of her drawings, but Mary Gibbs is the daughter of one of the Pixar story artists, and they initially used her, or they thought they were going to use her, for sort of like test type animations and like references and stuff. Mm-hmm. But they were sort of enamored with her babbling and said, you know what, let's just use it. Like,
that's great.
She's like a 3-year-old in the movie, so let's do it. So yeah, they just used like a Pixar staff's kid, which isn't that weird for Pixar. Like, a lot of people end up just being like small characters or like one line folks, and you're like, oh, who voiced that person? Oh, it was just like that storyboard artist down the hall.
Yeah, well, I was thinking through the movie, I was like, whoever voiced or wrote and voiced the baby talk in this is great, because it's just, it sounds so authentic. It's because it is, so that makes sense.
It's literal baby talk, which I think was the right move. I mean, baby talk so frequently sounds stupid in movies and TV, so I'm glad that it worked out for them, because they could avoid all that.
Yep.
And she's literally babbling. My favorite thing is, like, at one point, and I don't remember when it is because it's completely out of context, you can tell that she's like, I'm ticklish. And you're like, okay, cool.
I hear her mention Tigger at one point, too.
It's perfect, because it's exactly how kids are.
Mm-hmm.
You already mentioned Randall as Steve Buscemi. I think he does good. I don't know that I would have necessarily at the time thought of him as a villain. Now he's probably done a little bit more, but I think he does a good job.
Mm-hmm.
Randall's weird. I hate Randall's eyes. I think they improve them later on, but I hate his eyes so much.
Oh, I didn't really...
Because they just, like, literally roll around in his sockets, like, eyelids at all. It's really weird.
Oh, like, are they trying to sort of emulate, like, the way Chameleon's eyes just sort of, like, roll around because they're outside, but didn't really do it very well because they're inside his head?
Well, and I'm not really sure, because, like, I think that's what they're trying to emulate, but I also don't know if they were trying for it to be unsettling and then it just became too unsettling.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really sure, but I don't like the way that his eyelids, like, roll around in his sockets. It's really gross. Roz, who's, like, one of my favorite Pixar characters of all time.
Yeah, she's fun.
Is actually voiced by Bob Peterson, who is not a voice actor. He's a Pixar person. And he's a Pixar guy. He's an animator. But he also then goes on, like many Pixar folks do, to co-direct Up. He was a writer on Finding Nemo and Cars 3. But he's, like, just a guy that worked at Pixar who did this funny voice that they liked and really worked for this character. So... yeah, Bob Peterson is the voice of Roz, which is really great.
Love it.
Yeah, he's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Henry Waternoose is voiced by James Coburn, who's like who is like a pretty old dude, but like sort of like a Clint Eastwood type.
Okay. Yeah.
Who
I
did
see
like
that.
Westerns and stuff like that. I didn't recognize him.
Recognized his name, but I'm sure that I probably seen something with him in it, but I'm not sure.
And then the fun stuff, Celia May is Jennifer Tilly, who is great.
Love her, totally wasted in this movie, but she's great.
Yeah, she's not, her character, Celia May is not, like, used super well.
I was really mad about that, because I wanted to like her character, but I was just like, wow, she's just the naggy girlfriend. Like, she has a nice little moment at the end, but I'm like, you got Jennifer Tilly, and she's really funny, and can be really funny, and she's nothing about her is funny in this movie, because she's given nothing to do, but...
Yeah. Yep. It's literally only enjoyable because it's Jennifer Tilly's voice.
Exactly. Yep.
And a cool design, I guess.
Yeah.
She's like a character who gets like tentacle legs instead of like bigger main characters. Fun fact, and you can see this on Pixar's website. They have an animation of this. Sullivan, or Sully, was initially like a tentacle-legged person. And ooh, they decided for a main character that was too distracting.
Yeah, I did see, I looked up a, so I was looking up other, I'll get to that later. I was looking up another thing, but I came across like a test animation that had Sully with the tentacle legs. And he was trying to pick out a tie. And then Mike was there with no arms. He was just the eyeball head with legs.
Yeah. Okay, you found good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then John Ratzenberger and Bonnie Hunt are worth mentioning because they're in a bunch of Pixar movies. So John Ratzenberger is the Yeti and Bonnie Hunt is Ms. Flint, who's that character at the very beginning.
Oh.
Who's like guiding that monster through the simulation.
I recognized Ratzenberger, obviously. I totally missed that was Bonnie Hunt at the beginning. Cool.
Yeah. So, okay, I feel like you probably have a lot of story things you want to get to. So where do you want to start with story stuff?
Ooh.
Or just general stuff?
Ooh, where do I want to start with story stuff? That's a good question.
I was really curious to get your take on the story of this, like this movie's story, because I do think it's pretty simple.
It is. So, okay. Well, here's the thing. The only thing that I should say too, the only thing that I remembered from this movie going into it was the ending, which was like learning that they can use children's laughs instead of screams. Really remembered nothing else about the movie at all. I remembered Boo.
Like any of the beats along the way or like even, did you even remember like what the conflict was?
No, I didn't remember who the villain was. It was so like, I mean, it's
that's
obvious.
Incredible.
It would have been nice if it was like a bigger surprise. And I kind of figured that Waterdeuce was in on it just because
he's like the only scary looking monster.
Right. And like, I was like, that would make sense. So I guess that.
Yeah.
But so I figured that out. But you know, I didn't remember that Randall existed. I like vaguely remembered Celia
that
when
even
I saw
existed.
Her.
Nope. Oh my gosh.
Nope,
wow.
Did not sing. I remembered Mike, Sully, and Boo. Those were the only characters I remembered Roz like in general, but I didn't remember what her name was or even like what she sounded like, other than like, oh, she's an old lady and maybe she's boring, I guess. I don't know. She's way more awesome than that, so that's cool.
She's dope as hell.
Yeah, so that was it. So, you know, I guess I remembered the basic concept of them going through doors to scare children, but like, yeah, remembered nothing of the conflict. So like that stuff was kind of a surprise to me. I knew that Randall was a bad guy, but I didn't know what the plan was. So I was kind of on board with like, oh, he's cheating for a higher score. Okay. Yeah. I guess this will just escalate. I was sort of surprised. I was surprised when they throw in the hint of that not being the case when he's just like, yeah, sure, cheating. And I was like, oh, so I really have no idea what's going to happen. So, you know, the whole sucking their screams out thing, I was just like, okay, like kind of along for the ride for it. Again, it's simple. Like I figured that they were just going to be straight up murdering kids, but they're also, I guess, going to be suffocating them. So like basically killing them, maybe. I don't know. I'm fine with them that they left that kind of vague.
there are a number of things that this movie doesn't address, like universe wise and that's one of them, and that's not really like a universe thing, but it like is in a category of many things that I feel like they're better off not exploring.
Yeah,
you know what I mean,
they treat it as enough of a bad thing.
Yeah.
That it's like, I mean, that they're still kidnapping kids and sucking screams out of their bodies or whatever the fuck that means. Like,
it's basically,
that sounds bad enough. So that's fine.
It's their way of making literal the idea of we're going to do anything at the expense of these children to make sure we can power our city.
Yeah.
Like, that's the idea. They just, it manifests as this weird scream-sucking device.
Yeah. So that's the other thing that, so I was ultimately surprised that, like, a big part of it, not, you know, not the focus of the movie, obviously, but like a big part of it is sort of like barely a metaphor, like a very thinly veiled metaphor for like capitalistic corporations, like strip mining the world for their own, you know, desires to make profit. And there's obviously like some weirdness mixed up in it because they're apparently the only source of power, like electricity essentially in the entire monster world, I guess. So like they obviously have
at
a
least Monstropolis, at least that major metropolitan area. That's one of those things they don't explore, right? Like is this just how this city operates? Like does the rest of the monster world do things differently?
Yeah, that's a good thing about that.
You know, I have no idea.
Yeah. So, like, it is weird because, yeah, obviously they're, like, an essential business. They're, like, more of a utility than a corporation, but they are still a corporation owned by a guy who is willing to do anything to keep his company afloat, you know, which is, like, a very obvious, like, kind of anti-capitalist message ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact, yeah, the fact that it's basically, like, strip mining. Like, they can't scare children as easily anymore, so they're going to, like, suck the screams out of kids that I feel like would just kill them, which is going to deplete their source of screaming even faster, you know, which is, you know, kind of a whole thing that happens in the real world with real world resources and stuff. So,
well, instead of finding clean solutions like laughter.
Exactly. Exactly. So I thought that was kind of cool because that was like a depth to it that I wasn't expecting, you know? So yeah,
oh,
I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. It's funny because even if you asked me to describe what the movie was about, like, I wouldn't have thought to be like, well, it all starts with an energy crisis. Like, that's not even the thing I would focus on, because it's not the thing that, like, it's the thing that complicates the conflict the heroes are going through. Like,
yeah,
the reason the bad guys even get in their way is because of this energy crisis. But, like, that doesn't really concern Sully or Mike directly. You know what I mean? It's like kind of an interesting way to go about it. Like,
yeah,
the conflict ends up intersecting with them as opposed to it really being their conflict. Because Mike and Sully's whole thing is literally just getting Boo back home. Like, it's literally just like Sully recognizing that their monsters, which are humans, aren't actually scary, and so maybe we should care about what happens to them. So let's get her back home. And
yeah,
then they intersect with this like greater world conflict.
Right. And I think that me paying so much attention to the energy crisis stuff is just a product of like watching it kind of as an adult with like a lot less nostalgia.
Yeah.
Cause I really was, I was definitely engaged with the actual, you know, character stuff that was happening. Obviously we'll get to that, but I was just so surprised and kind of engaged with that world building and like the metaphor of that
yeah.
stuff. You know?
No, it's important. It's like central stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I think you could very easily watch the movie and just like if you're not really thinking about it, like if you're not like preparing to process it, you might not even think about that part. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So yeah, I mean, but I like that. Well,
yeah.
Character stuff. What character stuff?
So, okay. This will probably segue into my Mike hot take, I think, but it's not really, it's more like a warm take because I'm honestly of two minds of it. Cause I don't know. I could easily be swayed that I'm like fully wrong about it. So I really like Sully and Boo's relationship, which I think is like, obviously, right. Like it's not anything new. It's a very archetypal, like, you know, guy learns to warm up to a kid and becomes sort of like a dad figure, essentially. Like plenty of dad characters are out there. And I love that. I think that all of that stuff is done extremely well, actually. And independently of that, I think that, yeah, Mike and Sully play off of each other really well. Mike's role in the story makes a ton of sense. Mike is very funny. Like, Billy Crystal is very funny. All that stuff is great. I did, like, get the sense when I was watching the movie that, like, I felt a lot more interested in the Sully-Boo stuff. And whenever, like, the Mike and Sully stuff was brought to the forefront as like emotional points, like where there's sort of supposed to be some kind of emotional conflict between them that they have to get over. For me, that stuff didn't really work as well. Weirdly. And I was surprised by that, I think. And I think maybe part of it is because the saturation of this movie, like in the cultural consciousness and from like marketing and everything, has always been that the movie is about Sully and Mike's like friendship and relationship. The whole end credits are just them singing to each other about how they're best friends and everything. So like, obviously
yeah.
That's an important part, but like when I was watching the movie, like I liked them as characters, but I feel like I wasn't maybe it's just me, but I wasn't really as invested in their friendship as much. Like I get Mike's role in the story and it wasn't like I didn't care about their friendship stuff, but like when they have the moment, you know, when they're both exiled and like they basically have their breakup because Sully wants to go off and help Boo and Mike's like, dude, you're not listening to me the whole time. For me, like I didn't feel like that was particularly like built up to enough. And I don't know why that was. And again, I feel like maybe I just wasn't really vibing with it earlier on. So it, to me, that sort of didn't feel like it came out of nowhere, but it didn't feel like I just wasn't as interested in that stuff. And also it gets like wrapped up and solved like immediately afterwards. And I'm like, how did you get back to the monster world so quickly, Mike? I don't understand. But anyway.
No, they don't explain how Mike gets back at all.
Yeah. And, you know, so he comes back and he's just like, yeah, I was wrong. We're friends. It's fine. And I'm like, okay. So like so there wasn't really a catharsis to the conflict that they had at all anyway. So like for me, it almost felt like the primary story was Sully and Boo, and that was effective and worked. Mike makes sense as sort of like that side comic relief character that has to be involved to help get the story moving and to sort of be there. But the conflict between them and that being like a big emotional beat, or their whole friendship in general being such a fundamental emotional part of it, to the point that the entire movie is sort of framed as the story about these two buds and like the sort of buddy comedy, and the marketing is all about those two buds. Like, and I didn't really feel like that was the strong part of the movie. Like, it was fine, but I don't really feel like I was that interested in that. Before I close it off, I will automatically point out, provide a counterpoint in that if they didn't let there be an emotional connection between Sully and Mike, because I do think that he was pretty fundamental and instrumental to the movie. Like, he needed to be there as a character and his role needed to be there. If they stripped that out, then he would just be a really flat comic relief character. And maybe I would complain about that too. Like, they did sort like, I do like that they still added a lot of dimensionality to their friendship and added emotion to it. I just think the way that it's framed is like such a big part of the movie, I didn't feel like worked for me as much. Like, I didn't really need that, I guess.
I think that, well, one thing to consider for sure is that all these early Pixar movies are like 80 to 90 minutes long. And so I think like some of it might have been explored further earlier on or deeper if this movie were more of a modern Pixar movie that sometimes are longer. But even then, I'm not totally sure based on the tone of what this movie is. I do think when you look at Sully and you look at Mike and their relationship and you treat Boo, you're not supposed to do this, but if you treat Boo simply as a problem and not as a character, I do think it makes sense because you have Sully and Mike who are such good enough friends that they're literally roommates, and like work together and they're best buds. And their goal together as friends and coworkers is to smash the all-time scare record, which is like making the two of them like a big deal. And for Mike especially, I think that is probably more of a point of pride than Sully, because I think Mike's character is one that comes across as less secure and less sort of like he's not like the hero of the duo, right? He's more of the sidekick of the duo. So I think to him the stakes are actually higher. And so when you have this problem that gets in between them and Sully is so quickly just like casting off the thing that Mike is like, this is our thing, I think that's the thing we're supposed to sort of latch on to.
Sure.
But it is hard because the bigger relationship that shines on screen is the warm relationship between Sully and Boo. I mean, you have two relationships, one that's falling apart and one that's growing, one that's getting colder and one that's getting warmer. Like, you're going to gravitate more towards the ones that's getting warmer.
Yeah.
But I think Sully and Mike make sense. I think, I don't know how much of that is coming from, you know, living with this movie for so long, you know, as opposed to like, I wish I could like watch it without any sort of context, because I do get what you're saying, but I do think they work, like, and I think that their journey together works despite a couple details being left out about like, why does Mike come around? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess like, I mean, you're right. I think I actually agree with you. I think that they work. I think they make sense. I guess parsing it out, I guess my problem with it is less like on the base level, like the foundation of if they work or not, because I think that they do. I don't think the movie could exist if you eliminate Mike as a character, and I don't think it could exist if Mike and Sully's relationship isn't highlighted in some way. I think it's like the balance is kind of weird, I guess, because I think, you know, you were describing sort of the parallel relationships of like the warmer relationship between Sully and Boo that's building, and the relationship between Sully and Mike that's falling apart. And I feel like all of the emotion is put into building up Sully and Boo's relationship. But even though more time, I guess, probably arguably is spent between Mike and Sully their relationship falling apart, I don't feel like is highlighted in that time.
No, I think that makes sense. And even as you were saying that, I was sort of like, I think the paths were converging a little bit because mm-hmm. they don't really show us the stakes for Mike. You kind of have to put the pieces together.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't feel as much like Mike's world is falling apart because Sully is throwing things away, but that is what's happening. They're just not showing maybe enough of it. And so Mike ends up coming across as just like constantly screaming, "What are you crazy? Who cares?" Like, Mike comes across as like a "who cares, Sully" type of character,
as opposed to
you're throwing everything we've worked towards away. And I do think you probably only would need to insert like a scene that's a bit more Mike focused mm-hmm. or something. You know, I don't know if maybe that's drawing out the Yeti scene a little bit more, because that's where we see them actually confront each other.
I think before that, it should have been more clear.
I think it should have been more clear before that. But even in a moment like that, you see Mike sort of sit there and say, like, "Are you willing to throw our friendship away?" But I don't know that they built up exactly why he considers their friendship so intertwined with what's going on.
Yeah.
I think you can piece it together, but I think you're right. I don't think the movie necessarily builds it up for us enough. It's sort of like what you and I talk about sometimes, where it's like, how much work are we having to do versus how much work is the movie doing for us?
Yeah.
And the movie probably didn't do enough work for us to establish why Mike's life was falling apart as a result of this.
Yeah, it's weird because I agree with you. And I think that they vibe really well together. And I think that, you know, when you're watching it as a kid, I think because they vibe really well with each other and play off of each other so well, and the fact that Mike is really funny, like, I don't think you really, like, you know, you're not paying really attention to that as a kid. You buy into their friendship, and then when they have a fight, you're sad about it. But then it doesn't age as well because you're not really seeing that reflected as thoroughly as I think the movie wants you to think you have. Like, it really does feel like there are scenes cut on the Mike end in terms of the disintegration of their relationship. And also, like, you know, the movie is sort of presented as, like I said, kind of a buddy comedy with these two at the forefront. But I feel like Sully is like the hero of the story in the context of the movie, and Mike is very much like the sidekick. And I think that to make their relationship falling apart work, I think that it needed to have both of them be sort of in a protagonist role a little bit more. Like, I don't know how you make that work, but like, if they want to, I don't know. That might be breaking the movie too much.
No, I think the best way to approach this movie is to treat Sully like the singular main character. And I think that's probably the best way to look at it for things to make the most sense.
Yeah.
Because it isn't an odd couple story, and it isn't like a buddy cop film. It's not like a heist type thing with a team. Like, this movie really is about like the journey that Sully goes on, and it does affect Mike. Like, you know, any journey a main character might go on that changes their relationships. But I do think that is probably the best way to approach it, is this is a movie about a guy at the top of his game who suddenly questions the game and how that affects all the people around him.
Yeah.
There's just not a really big cast, so the only person it directly affects is Mike. Like, Sully doesn't have a significant other at all. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, he doesn't have anybody but Mike, presumably. So you don't necessarily see it the way that you might if it were the same movie, but it was affecting all of his relationships.
Yeah.
I think Celia is probably the thing that's supposed to tell us how much this is affecting Mike, but I don't think that's the right thing.
No.
I don't think it's the right way to go about it. You know what I mean?
No, because that's the thing, is that they also want to have Celia be kind of like a joke character, of being like sort of the naggy girlfriend who's left out of the loop. And then when she's in the loop, she helps. Like, so I think there needed to be some kind of actual real stakes with Celia, or like, I don't know, like have her involved in some way to do something, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it does. I do think the answer is in the fact that Mike was not originally part of the main trio. It was a duo, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the movie was about Sully and Boo. And I think you've hit upon exactly how that affected the ultimate product, mm-hmm. which is that Mike isn't a main character despite graduating to the place of a main character in marketing and then in the sequel. You know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah, I guess this is probably one of those cases where, because I don't have really any nostalgia for this movie because I barely remembered it, being affected by being exposed to the marketing for such a long time and the memes mm-hmm. and stuff, because they're very Mike-centric. and very Mike and Sully centric. And so that's sort of like, that was probably an expectation I went into that I wasn't even realizing was like an expectation that wasn't really correct. That like, this is a movie about Mike and Sully. And it's like it kind of is in some ways. And like, even like I said, like in the end credits, kind of wants to make you believe that the whole time it was about Mike and Sully being buds, I guess. But like, the movie's not really about that.
I don't think the movie is ultimately about that. I do think the movie is ultimately about Sully, but I do think the movie wants you to trust them when they say they're best friends.
Yeah, sure.
And I think that's part of the problem, right? Sure. Is like, trust us when we say these two are best of friends. And then, you know, Monsters University being a prequel, I don't know if you even knew that.
Oh, I knew that.
Sort of
yeah.
like, okay. Sort of like fills that in a little bit, because then you're like, okay, now we've seen the history, but that didn't exist at the time, you know?
Yeah.
So they really are just sort of like, I'm not going to say they don't establish it at all. They do establish that they're best friends, but they just sort of say like, trust us when we say that they're best friends, and wouldn't it suck if they weren't, you know?
Right.
And it's like, we all know that, like you're saying, like you recognize it. You're like, oh man, they're best friends, so I'm sad. But typically you would see a bit more to back that up, or you'd heighten the stakes or something. But you know, that's sort of the thing with these movies going through so many different iterations that I do think ultimately land them in better places than they were, but you still end up seeing, I guess, some residual stuff sort of creeping through, which is funny to say, because I do think Mike Wazowski's such a fantastic character.
Yeah, he's really fun.
And I think like the main trio all are just incredible. So yeah. Like, it still ends up like landing as far as like character stuff goes. It's the relationship stuff, I guess. It's really the only thing that suffers. I think that's probably a bit throughout the movie, because like even just Randall's relationship to them, I think even that sort of thing, it's like, it feels like there's more, even though there's not. You know, there's a relationship between Sully and Waternoose that you are also kind of just like told exists. So I do think like they do, you know what, maybe Monsters, Inc. is maybe the first of these movies, I'm sort of thinking in the moment here, to really sort of like tackle more realistic human-like relationships than the other movies prior to it.
I think
because
you're
Toy
right.
Story is a, because Toy Story is the relationship, it's all from the point of view of toys and their relationship to their human, right? Mm-hmm. It's a loyalty thing more than it is a relationship thing to one another. They don't really get into that until later. And then A Bug's Life doesn't really explore relationships. That's not what the movie's about. So I think this might be the first one to really tackle these like interpersonal conflicts that feel human.
Sure.
And I think maybe it shows a little bit in how they actually appear.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Because I think that was the thing that I felt was sort of missing in this movie, was that like really feeling super emotionally invested in a lot of the like relationships and what the characters are going through to the same extent as the past few movies. Not to say that I wasn't, like, I was into this movie when I was watching it. A lot of the stuff was really afterwards just feeling like sort of unsatisfied in certain points. And there were points that definitely did make me emotional, but it really wasn't until like the very end, like very, very like last shot of the movie got me really emotional, but little else really did, which wouldn't be a big deal normally, but it's compared to like other Pixar movies that we've been watching for this podcast and other ones that I've seen where I get very, very emotionally invested into it. So it sort of surprised me that given that, like you said, I agree. I really like the characters like independently, and I sort of like their relationships kind of in concept and everything. But it was just surprised that like, I feel like I should be more like in on this movie. And for some reason I'm just not. And I think you're right. I think you hit the nail on the head. They just hadn't really mastered like the really basic human interpersonal relationships, because those things are just inherently more complex than the sort of more abstract conceptual relationships that they've been able to deal with so far.
And their individual journeys are all, I think, very clear. It's just their journeys together that don't necessarily hit.
Sure.
And when you think of Toy Story and A Bug's Life and A Toy Story 2, those are about like personal journeys. And so when you go beyond that, and this is the first attempt, I think that, yeah, that's interesting. Oh, I've never thought about it that way. That's why I love that we're doing this. This is great.
Yeah. It also makes me really interested to see, once we get to Monsters University, which is like, I know that's like them in college, which is seems really weird to me. But if you're sort of taking these characters that we all sort of like and imbuing some of the narrative finesse that they've had that they've been able to manage to sort of evolve with later on and apply it to those characters. I'm curious to see how that goes. It also, I don't know. I feel like I never heard anyone ever talk about that movie. So I don't know if it's considered to be like one of the higher tier or lower tier movies. I have to imagine not higher tier if no one ever talks about it, but I can't imagine that it's bad either. So I don't know. I'm excited to get to it.
Can't wait to get to that one for sure. Especially because it's a late sequel, which I think is always interesting.
Yeah. Or prequel.
Or late prequel. Whatever.
Whatever.
Late new entry.
They are doing, I did hear that they're doing like a sequel series to this for Disney Plus, right? Like the monsters at work or whatever.
I did come across that when we were, when I was looking at stuff for this movie, and I remember them announcing that, but I don't know much about it. I'm sure I read about it at some point, but... When you said monsters at work, that sounded super familiar.
I looked up on Wikipedia, and I mean, I know that it takes place after this movie, and John Goodman and Billy Crystal are both in it, so like...
Oh, dang, I didn't even know that.
Yeah, that's the most that I know about it. I think it's supposed to come out in 2021, so...
I mean, the fact that they're in it and that it is a Disney Plus exclusive, I think, is probably a good sign.
Yeah.
But it is interesting because Pixar doesn't really make series,
mm-hmm.
so I'm excited to see what that turns out to be like.
Yeah, totally.
And, you know, this will be more of a conversation when we talk about Monsters University. Interesting that we're actually getting like a sequel. Uh-huh. Because no one knew what Monsters University was going to be for a very long time, and so it was assumed to be a sequel.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that they're doing a Disney Plus sequel series, cuz after watching this and knowing that Monsters University is a prequel, I'm like, I kind of am interested in what happens with these characters after this movie. Like, I'm not like normal. Yeah. A lot of times I'm like totally fine with a movie ending where it's at, and even if it's an open-ended ending. But with this one, I'm just like, I feel like there's a lot more room to flesh out the world in the way that they didn't do. Kind of like with A Bug's Life, actually.
I think that Monsters... More so than A Bug's Life, because I think the A Bug's Life sequel contingent is probably a lot smaller than the Monsters one was. I think the way that Monsters, Inc. ends invited everybody to basically say, like, we need to know what happens next.
Yeah.
Like, you can't end it there, even though I think the ending is beautiful.
The ending is very – I love the ending. And I'm not mad that we didn't get a sequel. And
totally.
I guess we are getting a sequel in some form. But, like – I mean, it's less even like following the characters necessarily after this movie, though I want to see more of them, but more just because I feel like so much of the world of this movie is so unexplored, like so much.
And the world fundamentally changes by the end of this movie.
Right.
They literally show us that like the power of laughter as an energy source is far greater than Scream. So like they didn't just find a replacement energy source. They found one that's like powerful enough to activate millions of doors in the factory. Like,
yeah,
you know, like I don't know if they'll even get into that, because I don't even think that's the thing they care the most about, because I do think it was more of a world building thing. But mm-hmm. I would be curious, like if they touch upon that at all. Like,
I did see that there was like a comic sequel to the movie that was written. That's maybe a few years ago or something. I don't really know when I was looking up the Monsters at Work stuff. So I don't know anything about it, but I know that it's like it was meant to be kind of a sequel to the movie.
Ooh,
that I'm sort of curious about, but
read that in anticipation of our Monsters University one.
Okay.
Even though it's not that, but I will probably still do that. I know they made like a quote manga adaptation that looked awful.
Oh, that's
but I haven't
sad.
Read it, so I don't know. I think it was, I don't know who did it, but it looked pretty bad. I haven't read it though, so maybe it's good.
You could do such cool, like, you could do such cool manga designs with these monsters, so that's really disappointing.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, were they going to if they're all supposed to be cute? You know what I mean?
That's true.
What else was a surprise to you, or what else sort of like stood out to you, especially having not really remembered a whole lot?
The humor was kind of interesting, because it felt like at certain points I was like, I feel like this is less funny than like the past few Pixar movies, but when it is funny, it's really, really funny. I think it's just a different vibe. Like, it's not as dense with the jokes, I guess. I think is maybe what it is, especially compared to Toy Story, which is fine, because like when there are jokes, they're good. Like, they're often a little more complex jokes, I think, than a lot of Toy Story jokes often were, or even like a little bit meta, like Yeah, like I laughed out loud, really loud, at the bit when Randall has Mike held hostage and was going to use the scream sucker thing on him. And, you know, Randall was like, "You thought I was cheating?" And Mike's like, "Well, I did, right up until you chuckled like that." I thought that was hilarious. Stuff like that. Yeah, I think there was a little bit more, calling it meta humor isn't even right. Just like a little bit more like self-aware, like kind of commentating on like typical story beats a little bit.
Sure.
Which I think works when you have somebody like Billy Crystal, too.
I think that's a big piece of it, because I think with Toy Story, it's even though that movie is largely, the first one is largely about Woody and Buzz, and the second one is largely about Woody, they both have an ensemble cast at any given moment. And everybody's allowed to tell jokes in those movies. Everybody's allowed to be funny in those movies, kind of on an equal playing field. And maybe a lot of that is because so many of those voice actors are comedians. But in this case, like, Mike isn't the only one who gets to be funny, but he's primarily the one who's funny most of the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that's part of a vibe shift for them, is to have like an explicitly comedic character as opposed to a comedic cast.
Yeah.
Or not even a comedic cast. Like, Toy Story's not a comedic cast. They're just sort of like even. You know what I mean? They kind of share humor responsibilities. Ham tells jokes. Mr. Potato Head tells jokes. Woody tells jokes. Freaking Etch-A-Sketch tells jokes. Like, everybody tells jokes in those movies. I think that's why it's so dense.
Yeah, like, Toy Story is like like early Simpsons vibes to me, where it's just every character has a thing that they mm-hmm. can use to implement funny things. And then this movie, like, not every character has a thing. Like, some characters are just there to be characters that exist in the world, which is fine. It's just a different, it's a different style of storytelling than I think we've gotten yet in a Pixar movie.
And more distinct styles of humor, I think, between characters than even Toy Story. Like, they all have their distinct thing, but I think the humor is pretty consistent.
That's
Whereas here you have, like, Mike Wazowski has a very particular type of humor. Sully is funny almost entirely physically, not necessarily verbally.
Yeah.
And then you have Roz, who is the most deadpan type of funny ever.
Yep.
And so I think everybody's kind of got a different brand as opposed to just, like, a different gimmick.
Yeah, yeah.
Although there are gimmicks. Like, you have the whole, like, Georgie thing where he keeps getting... I love that character. It's so stupid. The guy that keeps getting... Yeah.
I felt so bad for him. I love it. I know. He's just, like, this, like naked monster for most of the movie. Like, he even has little nipples. It's so cute.
I know. I love after all is said and done, right? After he's been shaved, after he's been tackled, like, twice, he's still like, all right, let's do this. And his walk is so, like... So, like, bubbly. Like, he's got, like, a bounce in his step. So, mm-hmm. by the end of the movie, he ends up just being this, like, naked, patchy, like, nippled, coned, like, bubbly monster. Who knew we were going to talk about Georgie? But I love at the end when he finally is just like, you know what? Screw it. You shut your damn mouth. Like, we're not doing this.
Yeah, he's great. I really liked him a lot.
Yeah, he's great. He's voiced by he's one of the examples of somebody voiced by just like a random Pixar person, because his voice actor is like a software engineer, which is cool because the software engineers are like the unsung heroes of Pixar.
Absolutely.
They're the ones that like make all this shit work. Like that fur would not exist.
Yep. Yeah. I liked him. I like the joke of like Celia with her snake hair, and she's like, I'm thinking of getting it cut, and the snakes are freaked out. It's like, oh my god. Okay.
Yep. Don't like that.
That said, it's like, I think part of my frustration with Celia is that Jennifer Tilly's great and it sucks that they wasted her, but also like it made me realize how few women there are in any Pixar movies up to this point.
Oh my gosh. I know, which is weird, because like I know Pixar is still, at least at the highest points, like still pretty much a boys club. And what's funny about it is, you know, a lot of the people of the generation of the leadership at Pixar are people who were frustrated at the sort of like, what is it, the seven old men of Disney or whatever,
mm-hmm.
that sort of like were largely gatekeepers of what Disney was. And I don't think that Pixar does the same thing Disney does. I think it actively tries not to, but you still sort of ended up with this situation where at least at the very beginning, the entire brain trust was just a bunch of dudes who were friends, mm-hmm. which makes sense based on how Pixar got started. But all those people, with the exception of John Lasseter, for the most part are like still there in creative roles. What's surprising though is like this movie is, I mean, there is a female writer for the story. That one, the producer, the main producer, is a woman, and you see that throughout Pixar, where like there are women in the room, and yet there are still so many, or rather, so few, like fleshed out female characters until we get to what, like Incredibles, and then it's still an ensemble cast,
and even,
you know?
like Brave, it's still like I'm not like other girls, like there's still
is an element of that, yeah. Like, I can't wait to talk about that one. I haven't watched that one in a while.
Yeah, they're definitely better about it now, but totally. It's still like the ratio is still bizarrely uneven, and it's still like so many movies that are coming out still now. Yeah. It's like, yeah, you know, you're two dude protagonists, and then the girl, and she's a fleshed out girl and a better character than like Celia, for example, was, but it's still like the one girl to a bunch of dudes. Like, it's really weird. And surprising, because they do so well with so many other things. So I don't know.
Yeah, Pixar is definitely not without its faults, especially when it comes to not necessarily even how it portrays women anymore, but just how infrequently it portrays women.
Yeah,
definitely getting a lot better.
At least they're getting better.
Yep. But it shines through a lot in these early ones, especially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know why I laughed so much at this joke, but I really liked the first joke I think I laughed out loud at in the movie was Sully, like, not knowing what puce was and then learning what puce is. And it's like, that's puce. It's great.
Yeah, I like that.
I love Boo. And I really like that she gets a little empowering moment where she overcomes her fears and like pushes Randall and stuff. Like, love that. That's great. I do think it's like funny if you're thinking of it in context that she's like, I know that like she's like in her terrible twos or terrible threes, but she is like such an ill-behaved child in so many ways, which again makes it funny. But she also like literally pushes down Sully's TV like off of the dresser, which seems like a little bit over the top even for like a rampaging 3-year-old.
I guess so. I think
that's not even a criticism. I just thought it was hilarious because I'm like, this girl, there needs to be a little bit of discipline in her life, I think.
She's free. She's free of her parents.
That's
you know?
True. Maybe
she's living with a big kitty.
That's true. This is just, this is like her dream world, I guess.
Yeah. I do like that the movie tackles the sort of like overcoming your fears from both ends, because you do have Boo, who could have just been this sort of like rampagey, sort of like confident kid, right? Like ultimately that's what Boo's character is, like characterization is supposed to be, is that she's brave. Like she's a brave little kid, but they still allow her to be afraid of Randall, who is sort of like the always scary monster as opposed to the like career scary monster. Even other monsters are afraid of Randall. And so while all these monsters are sort of collectively overcoming their fear of humans, you still get to see like a human in real time sort of overcome her own fear of her monster, which is cool.
Yeah. And I think for the most part, other than like the fact that she's able to teleport or whatever, like
I was like, what are you talking about?
It's just like the Looney Tunes joke. She just, you know, just appears.
I think
it's fine. Other than that, I think she's actually portrayed like really realistically, which is fun.
She's funny. She's, I will say though, and this is only because it's early Pixar, she does suffer a little bit from like the unintentionally creepy human thing.
Yeah.
Not nearly as much as like the kid at the very end.
Oh, God. No,
or like, and I only point the kid out from the very end because he's like one of the few kids that's not like a robot child meant for like simulation. But he looks just like them anyway.
He also,
and yeah, he's
they
creepy.
Point out that he's in kindergarten, and that kid is definitely
no,
like
he's
13.
Not. Like, I know. I hate that so much. Like that child is like 13 years old.
Yeah,
this is why you're not scaring kids.
but the voice that they put to him when he laughs is clearly meant to be a little kid's voice.
It's terrible.
It's real
I hate
bad.
It. I wouldn't be surprised at all if it was a laugh from Pizza Planet. It sounds exactly.
Yeah.
Like the laughter at Pizza Planet. Like just some weird stock child laughter. But unfortunately, Boo does suffer a little bit from it because like her eyelashes are a little bit bizarre and her teeth are like a little too distinct. But I was surprised. They actually do a good job with her. Her eyes are actually really incredibly done as far as like expressions and stuff. I think more consistently like emotionally on point than a lot of the other characters are, with maybe the exception of Mike.
Yeah, she's a huge step up from Andy.
Oh my gosh. You just imagine Andy's baby sister. Yeah, Boo is far better than that. I mean, this is the first movie to have like a consistent human character.
Yeah.
So they do a pretty good job. I mean, they lucked out in that, not lucked out, they made the decision, but like the fact that she is like a tiny baby essentially and is frequently in a costume.
Yeah.
That was smart. That definitely helps. But they didn't not give themselves a challenge. Like, she is the first human character to be in the whole movie. She's also the first character to like wear realistic clothing. And so that was like a whole nother challenge where they were like, oh yeah, we probably have to put her in clothes, don't we? So like she has this baggy shirt that they had to figure out too. So
yeah,
even though she's a little weird looking, that's pretty incredible accomplishment on top of everything else they were doing.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Fully agree. Yeah. It could have been, way worse. It's definitely a big achievement that they made Boo not look like a freak.
I mean, the whole movie would have failed if she were. Let's be real.
It's like, who's the real monster here?
Right. You're supposed to care about her and think she's cute, and she is. So they succeeded.
Yep. I do like a lot of the background monster designs. I know I was kind of complaining that a lot of them are sort of like Muppety and cute, which, again, I'm not against. I think that I think a lot of the designs are really good and really creative. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the background ones I think are really cool because I think they clearly were having fun with making them as weird as possible. So, you know, you see all those, all the monsters with tons of eyes. There's a monster in the sushi restaurant that's like, I even forget what his main body looks like because he opens his mouth and a slug comes out of his mouth to eat the sushi.
I like that. It feels sort of like, is it like Alien or is it, feels sort of like a reference there.
Yeah. It's like it's kind of like the xenomorph thing with the second mouth inside of it. It's fun. There's the one, like, I guess, I think he was like kind of like almost a blue sort of reptile type dude, but he had in just one of the scarer worker guys. And he just has like super long tentacly arms. And he also cries, I think, cause that's the one where, wait, why does he cry? What does the kid, what does the kid do that makes him cry? I don't remember.
Is it the one that is scared because I don't know.
Oh no,
he almost touched me.
Him.
He got this close.
Yeah, he almost touched him. Yeah. So he comes out and he's like crying. I really liked him a lot. I don't know why. Yeah. He's just like, his design is so weird because he's like a reptile dude with like super long tentacle arms and he's crying. Like, well, it's great. Totally my vibe.
What's funny about this is as many things age sort of weirdly in this movie simply because of where technology was, not because they did anything poorly, the tentacles all age really well. Like, whatever they were doing to animate tentacles was really good, and I don't know if it's because they spent so much time on tentacles because they thought Sully was going to have tentacles that it was like, well, they're a main feature, like, we got to get it right. But like, I think they do a good job. Like, it's always smooth. It's frequently comedic. Like, there's a physical sort of comedy to a lot of them. It's smooth for the characters who are walking on tentacles, which is kind of what you want, because then it's a little bit unsettling. Like Celia, her animation is always smooth. So, one thing that doesn't age is one of the things I would have assumed would be one of the harder things to animate, but
yeah,
I guess
fully
not.
Agree. Fully agree.
Love the octopus in the sushi restaurant. Hate the way he moves. I think that's the character. I mean, the tentacles look good, but his body, that's one of the characters where I was like, this is just an animatronic. Like, I can see what you're doing. You're just sort of like, you have like, there's not literally a cycle, but like some characters, you can almost see the joints that they made. You know what I mean? It's like, this is a smooth, fleshy character. Why are they moving that way? But I also know some of it is like on the way to building those sort of like natural swaying movements that real people do. Mm-hmm. Like, there were some moments from Sully where it was like, you're not moving very smoothly, but I recognize that they're doing this because if you weren't moving at all, that would be even more unnatural. So it's like, I feel like there's a lot of like in between type of like progress happening in this movie where it's like, I see where you're going. You just aren't totally there yet.
Yeah. Although
the octopus made me feel that way.
I think that makes I agree with you. There's definitely some characters that are like that. I do think that one big step up for it is like the wear and tear on stuff. Like the scream canisters and the doors have a lot of really great scratches when you look at them. Mm-hmm. And it's the kind of thing that, like, you know, in 2001, you would only notice it if you were maybe seeing it in theaters. Like, you wouldn't have big enough TVs to see it now. So the fact that you can see it in HD and it's, like, so clear that, like, oh, these are all old and, like, used things, and they make that very apparent. Like, that's the one thing that I think about the factory setting that they get really, really right is, like, even though I don't love the lighting of it and, like, sort of the sterile look of a lot of their sets, they always look like people have been working there in a factory for a long time. Like, everything has wear and tear on it.
They're getting so quickly better at, like, textures and surfaces and stuff like that. I think even the Yeti's cave, even though the snow isn't animated super well, the way the snow looks and the way that cave and ice look, I was really surprised by.
Yeah.
Because I was expecting it to be far worse. You know what I mean? Like, you can't look too close because then you realize, like, there are no footsteps and there's no, like, nothing's affecting the environment the way that it should. But just the environment itself looks really cool.
Yeah. Speaking of him, I liked him. I like the idea that, like, Loch Ness Monster and Bigfoot and an abominable snowman. I mean, I guess any cryptid basically is like just been exiled from the monster world for whatever reason. It's like, what did you do to get this terrible punishment? I wonder.
Kept feeding kids pea snow cones. It's lemon, but I'm going to go outside to make more.
Yikes.
Okay, buddy.
I did like his joke when he's like, oh, I assumed you two were friends when I saw you out there hugging.
Yep.
Great. Love it. He's great. Love that the restaurant's name is Harryhausen's. Love that. So great. I could have done with more, like, sign gags and, like, name gags. I don't think that there are enough.
There are a decent number, though. Like, as they walk down the street, I think probably it's just that too many of them are, like, Easter eggy and not enough just, like, full-blown gags.
Like, I saw grocery is grocery, like, grossery, and I thought that was cute.
And there's, like, the coffee shop has, like, I think it's like coffee, espresso, and diesel. And then I think like the vending machine has all kinds of like weird sort of like products in it. Like I think raccoon or something like
that. Okay, so
like,
I just wasn't paying enough attention. That's fine then.
but they're in settings that aren't major features. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So like walking down the street, they spend so little time in the neighborhood, but that's kind of where they pack all of their sight gags into.
Yeah, and I feel like the sight gags were funnier than sometimes when they would reference stuff. Like, all the odorants stuff instead of deodorants, I was like, that's cute. And then it kind of went on for a while, and I'm like, okay, I get it. Like, oh, you like to stink instead of, like, smell what humans consider good. Okay, cool, fine.
Yeah.
I don't know what a monster truck rally is in their world. Like, it's funny that they bring that up as a thing that they want to go to and that it's just called a monster truck rally. But I'm very curious about, like, is it literally like a monster truck rally here? Or is it something very different? I don't know.
I don't know.
I have questions.
It could literally just be monsters driving trucks in a rally style race.
Could be.
I have no idea. I don't know. I would love to know, and this is a thing that I'm certain they had no interest in exploring because they don't, but Randall basically has like a superpower. And I feel like there are probably other monsters with like all kinds of different abilities. Like there's the one that sticks his eyes on, or there's like, there's like the monster that like blows his thumb and spikes pop out. Like they do imply that these monsters aren't all just like different looking to humans. Like some of them have different abilities. And I do think that's the type of thing that they're never really going to get into, but I'm fascinated by. Or like the one that slips through the grate on accident.
Dude, you could do something with that. Yeah, I guess maybe it's like in their world because they're probably a little more, they're probably like a little less vulnerable than like people are in our world. Maybe like they're probably just like stronger in general and stuff. Like
sure.
That maybe it's the equivalent to like, people that we know who just have cool skills. Like, oh, somebody is double jointed. Oh, like some of these actors can like move their eyes in cool ways that not everyone can. Like maybe Randall, it's like the equivalent of that, you know?
Randall is like the LeBron James of monsters, where it's like, I don't know how he has all those abilities, but he does. Yeah, and it makes him really good at scaring.
Right. Right.
I don't know how Sully roars that loud, but he does.
Mm-hmm.
I roar, but it's nowhere near that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
I love his roar. It's great. I loved Ted the Kaiju dude who collects like a chicken.
Did you watch this on Disney Plus?
I did. Okay. That was the thing that I was looking up, because Disney Plus does not have the bloopers. I distinctly remember bloopers. So yes. I was looking on YouTube to find them.
Okay.
And I did find that it was just because depending on the release you saw, and I guess like has the bloopers or doesn't have them, because they added them later. I fine, whatever. What's funny though is that the blooper reel that I looked up didn't have the blooper that I remembered, which I remembered the monsters like slow-mo walk entrance and they like slowly fall over, and the gag reel that I found on YouTube didn't have that, so I don't know if I looked at one that had all of them on it.
I don't think the one that I saw, or I don't think the gag reel I looked at had that either, and I'm wondering if that is that was that actually a blooper or was that a commercial or something?
Maybe that was the case, because I mean I saw all of these on TV, so maybe I saw that on TV too and just thought and that there was a blooper.
But I don't even know why I'm thinking that. It's just the thing that popped into my head when you described that. Because I wonder, I don't know. I would have to go back and look at like TV spots and commercials and stuff. Because I something in my brain is saying maybe that was more of a promotion than it was a blooper.
Yeah, that makes. I'm gonna look it up afterwards because I'm very curious now. Because that's for some reason that's the one that stuck in my head. And maybe if it was a commercial that I saw multiple times, it would make sense why it stuck in my head.
I asked you that because Rex is.
I was very excited when I saw that, and maybe a little extra mad that Disney Plus doesn't include the bloopers, because I was like, oh, I was robbed. But that's what YouTube is for these days. You can find anything, so it's fine.
I was hoping the bloopers would be a special feature on Disney Plus, but they weren't, like in their extra section.
Yeah, that's so surprising.
Especially because the bloopers include the musical. Like, they do the stage musical of Put That Thing Back Where It Came From. And, like, that's the one I always remember. I always remember that blooper because it's so funny to me that they actually, like, turn it into a musical.
Yeah, and it's wild. It's frustrating that it's not on Disney Plus because obviously a lot of work goes into making those bloopers. So, show it. Let people access it. Show it off.
Exactly. What else you got? Anything left?
I definitely could see the DNA of the airport sequence from Toy Story 2 in the door sequence.
But it's, you know what? It's so much bigger even than I remembered having watched it as many times as I have, because the airport scene from Toy Story 2 is like pretty expansive. This is literally millions of doors.
Yeah.
Like there are millions of individual doors.
And it goes on for a long time.
It's wild. It's honestly wild to me. I don't know why. Sometimes it just hits me, like, what they actually do to make these movies. Even knowing what they do, like, sometimes it just hits me harder. And when I was watching some of the special features for this specifically, like, watching them do test animations, did you see the fur tests that they were doing where they were, like, putting him through an obstacle course and stuff?
I did not, no.
Okay, I would recommend going on Pixar's website and going to the page for Monsters, Inc., this is probably the easiest place to find it. There's a maybe like few minutes long where they talk just about trying to get Sully's fur right. And one of the things they did was like put him through an obstacle course, because the thing that you can't really predict is how fur as a physical object is going to interact with other physical objects, because it's literally millions of physical objects, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so like after watching that, I was like, it's absolutely mind-boggling what they do to make these movies, you know? Like, it's obviously a totally different thing than traditional animation, which is mind-blowing all on its own.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that they literally rendered millions of doors just to make those door scenes, to flesh it out and make it feel like it has the appropriate depth.
Yep.
That's wild, because here's the thing. Even though that's all virtual stuff, if you make something virtually, that thing exists virtually. So they literally created millions of doors that are physical objects in that space.
Mm-hmm.
It's wild. It's just like mind-blowing when you think about it that way. You're like, my God.
And not only that, but the way that they had to choreograph the action sequences, because the rules of the doors are so not realistic at all, you know?
That
was really impressive. You know, the fact that you can enter a door and then basically be in another dimension and exit out of a door in a completely different space. And the fact that they had to like track the geography of that, since it was also a chase sequence, like that it was clearly like their ability to do a complicated action sequence and animate it, like their talents and skills were very on display there.
Yeah. Oh, there's so many flexes. So many. I mean, the millions of doors is a flex. I think that Sully sledding down the hill with a single lantern is maybe the film's biggest flex.
It looks so good.
You have wind, you have snow, and you have lighting all affecting his hair at the same time.
Yeah.
Incredible.
I was shocked by how good that sequence looked. Like, I think out of everything in this movie, I feel like that's the one that I feel like you could just cut out, paste into a movie from 2020, and it would look
so good.
Great. It would still
look
great.
I mean, I know exactly how they accomplished it. I mean, they put it in the middle of a snowstorm, but like, that's what you do then. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it ends up making the lighting even more dramatic anyway. So it's, I think that's probably the biggest flex of the movie, aside from, if not even more so than all the doors. The one thing I will mention, because I mentioned it at the top and I don't want to forget it, in the door scene when they're jumping from place to place, that's where, if you look really closely, and I don't know for sure, I would love to find more information about these specific mini scenes, or settings, I guess is the better way to put it, these like tiny settings. If you look, a lot of it actually looks like it might be a bunch of painted flat spaces. You know what I mean?
Interesting.
So like, when the one that really stands out is when they end up on like the sort of tropical island, nothing's really moving around them except maybe like clouds, or like in Paris, when they end up in Paris, I don't think anything's really moving except for the clouds in the background by the Eiffel Tower. Mm-hmm. And it's because they don't have to. I mean, they're literally running through the room sort of like you said, like Looney Tunes style kind of, where they're going from place to place.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't need to spend a lot of time on it. But if you pause and look at it, it's actually kind of cool, because it's the closest you sort of get at this point in time to like what appears to be a bit more traditional, even though I'm sure it's not.
Yeah.
I'm sure a lot of it is still like digital painting, but I wouldn't be surprised to find out that it's not, you know?
That makes a lot of sense. I sort of noticed, I noticed a little bit of that in a different way in when we see Randall go through that door and get kind of permanently exiled, and he's in like the swamp people.
Oh,
just people in a swamp. The trailer.
Do you know where that is?
Because it looked like it was like shadow puppets, like in that trailer that you see through the windows.
Yeah, but that's the trailer from A Bug's Life with the Pizza Planet truck right next to it.
Oh my God.
He gets banished to the trailer that is right outside of Bug City.
I didn't even realize it. I saw other references that did not even click with me whatsoever.
Yeah.
I think I was too kind of enamored by the shadow puppet look.
Yeah.
Of all the people, of the silhouettes behind the windows.
And I do think that's cool. And I know that's why you brought it up in the first place. So I do like that. And it is interesting to see sort of like different, for lack of a better term, like styles of animation, even though I'm sure they're doing them all sort of similarly.
Mm-hmm.
It is cool to see like variations like that. And, you know, future Pixar movies will like explore that in different ways, especially when it comes to like shorts and stuff. But at this point, like they were really known for like a particular style. So it's cool to see like little variations in there.
Mm-hmm. And I did notice like Boo has a Jesse toy and a little Nemo, which is the next movie after that, right?
So many Nemos. There are so many Nemos in this movie.
Oh, really?
And
that's the only one that I noticed.
Yeah, there's and that is what's significant about it, is that it's foreshadowing as opposed to like an Easter egg from a former movie. Because Finding Nemo's the next movie. There's like three or four different Nemo references. Because like at the sushi place, there's a clownfish behind the octopus. And then it's not where Randall is exiled, but it might be where they throw Randall at some point. I don't know. There's like a room that we don't fully get to see that has like wood paneling.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like a large clownfish model, like you might put like a bass fish, like hanging on the wall.
Interesting.
There's a bunch of Nemo in there.
That's so funny. Do they do a lot of like the foreshadowing stuff, or like, you know, next movie preview kind of in the future?
I think that's sort of like the most famous example of it, because it was such a big deal to be like, wait a second, did you foreshadow a movie through your Easter eggs? I wouldn't be surprised if they do it in other ones, but there aren't any that immediately come to mind. Like, if you'd asked me that question, this is the movie that I would say did it, you know?
Gotcha.
But I wouldn't be surprised, like, Brave has a bunch of Easter eggs, which is, like, weird considering the setting.
Huh, interesting.
So I wouldn't be surprised if, like, that might foreshadow something, but we'll have to see when we get to it.
Yeah. Interesting, interesting. I only have a few other couple spare things.
Sure.
I was a little worried when the movie kind of started off with some like fat jokes at Sully's expense, and I'm glad that that doesn't really continue after the beginning. And they're pretty light anyway. Like, they're not really mean-spirited or anything. I was just worried. Yeah. I was like, is that going to be a thing? Is that going to be like a thing that Mike does? And it isn't, which I'm very glad about, especially given Toy Story 2 and kind of the conversation that we had about that.
Yeah. I mean, even aside from just like they don't need to be there ever, like I don't even think it would work given like Sully's characterization. You know?
Yeah.
It just wouldn't make any sense.
No. That said, I love Sully's little tie at the end. It's adorable. It's great. Perfect. Love it.
Yep.
Best part of the movie.
You know what's funny is he's probably wearing like a regular size tie, but just like a human size tie. Cause I think he's like, what, 7 feet tall or
probably,
something?
Probably. Yeah.
It's probably a normal tie, but it looks teeny tiny on him.
It's great. Perfect. but yeah, actually, that whole ending is really good. I think one thing that I really liked about the ending, and you know, this might be a thing that's like answered in whatever other sequel stuff that they do, but I like that like they leave it ambiguous how much time has passed between. Like the, you know, the events of the movie and then the little like epilogue that they have at the very end. So you don't know how old Boo is when Sully comes back to her. And you also like, I feel like it's also kind of ambiguous how time even works. Cause I feel like you could argue that it's not like necessarily one-to-one, like how the timeline of the monster world works versus the human world. You know, like, I feel like it's kind of ambiguous.
Well, and that's a portal fantasy thing, so it wouldn't be weird if they did that. I mean, this isn't, like, a standard portal fantasy, but you do travel between two worlds through portals. So, like, if they wanted to implement a mechanic like that, where time is moving differently in different worlds, they very easily could.
Yeah, but either way...
Because they don't do anything to make it not the case.
Right, exactly. And honestly, there's probably, like, things that might... work better in the, like, explaining Boo being gone for so long, like, instead of having to worry about, like, okay, but do her parents think that she was kidnapped or something? You could just wipe that away and not even worry about it by saying, like, oh, well, in the real world, only, like, 8 hours have passed, and that's not a big deal.
Right. She was theoretically asleep the whole time.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think that it almost makes it a little, it almost makes things work a little bit better if you just assume that time flows differently.
Right.
But that aside, I like the ambiguity of the ending that you don't know how much time has passed because you don't see Boo. You hear her, and I guess she still sounds like a little girl, but, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter.
If she's three, she's going to sound like a little girl for, like, 6 more years probably, if not more.
Exactly. So, like, I think that works, and The point that I got the most emotional, if really the only point that I got really emotional, was that last shot of, like, Sully's face and smiling.
Oh, when he lights up. Oh, my gosh, yeah.
It's so good. Oh, my God. It's, like, top-tier ending to a movie. It's so perfect. Yeah.
You know what I really like about the ending that I hope they don't really fuck with in the sequel series?
Mm-hmm.
Sully goes through this whole journey, right, to realize that kids aren't monsters and that they have no reason to be afraid of them. And in fact, we're actually hurting them doing what we're doing. At the end of the movie, Sully is seemingly, and this is such a tiny part of the movie that they don't fully explore this, but from what we see, is seemingly totally content to have swapped roles with Mike and be his sort of assistant, right? I mean, they're still a team, but he's now doing administrative work as opposed to, like, the, quote, glory stuff, which is sort of elaborated on in Monsters U as far as, like, what type of monster role do you want to be? It's like your career. Some careers are glamorous and some aren't.
Right.
He seems completely content not to be in a glamorous space, which I think aligns with the journey he went on. I'm glad to see that at the end of this movie, and I hope that the sequel series doesn't make him miss that, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because I think it would fly in the face of the journey he went on if he were suddenly jealous of Mike without Mike being an asshole about it.
Yeah. Does he, like, own... Is there an argument to say that maybe he, like, actually is, like, running the company now? Like...
Sully?
Yeah, because this was his idea, and if Waternoose is gone, and, like, I know he's, like, giving Mike pointers or giving Mike support at the end, but he also, like, I don't know. I feel like you could argue that he's like overseeing the entire room.
I think you very easily could do that. I'd never thought of it that way, but I don't think it can't be the case. And I think that even if he were running the company, I think you could say he's running the company and be part of Mike's team.
Yeah.
And I think that would still feel fully natural to the relationship that they built up for those two over time. Maybe not as much in the movie.
Yeah, for some reason, that was just, like, my first thought when I was like, oh, does he own the company now because it was his idea? And, like, I know that's not how, like, corporations work. Like, I have an idea. Right as the CEO is fired, that means I get to run everything now. But I could sort of see that at the same time, you know, in their
I would like to believe that Roz is now in charge of the company since she did technically work there.
Yeah, I could see
Even though she was working there undercover, I feel like now that her cover's blown, like, she could just be in charge. But yeah, I have no idea. I'm assuming that the sequel will explore that, but thus far, I don't think we know.
That's my fan theory headcanon until I see it in Disney Plus, I guess.
Oh, question. Is Sully wearing glasses at the end when he has the clipboard?
No. Okay. No, he's not.
I only thought of that now because he was supposed to have glasses. Like, there was a period of time in development where he was supposed to have glasses, and they were like, this is a bad idea because eyes. But it would have been an interesting sort of, like, not even a joke, but, like, an inside reference if he were wearing glasses.
Yeah. Yeah. Or at least, I don't remember him wearing – I just thought
yeah, if ever there were a point where they could get away with it would be at the end where he sort of, like, reversed roles or whatever.
Right. But yeah, I think that Monsters, Inc., as of the movies that we've watched, I think is actually like my least favorite, but I still liked it a lot. Like, it's, you know, out of four movies that are all really good, you know. And I think it's not even on the conceptual level. I think maybe because I like the concept so much and I like a lot of the ideas and I like that it's a movie about monsters and I like Sully as a character in general, like in a million different ways. Like, I think in a weird way, the fact that I wasn't vibing with the narrative of it as much made it even more disappointing for me coming back to it. Cause I think maybe my bar was a little bit higher than it needed to be for it. But I still liked it a lot. And I still, like I said, got real emotional with it. Really like Sully's relationship with Boo, and Mike is funny, and as much as I, like, shit-talked the Mike Sully stuff, I do think that they have, independent of, like, the construction of the movie, I think that they have, I think they vibe together really well, and I'm excited. I know that Monsters University, I'm sure, is more centered on that relationship in one way or another, so if that's at the center of it, I'm excited to see how that plays out, because they do have a good, fun relationship, regardless.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think anything you were saying was an indictment on the development of any characters, just to, if you're worried about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think I probably agree with you. Not that we're necessarily doing like rankings or anything, but since there's so few we've watched so far, probably for me the same. I think a lot of people would be surprised to hear both of us say that, because I think most people would put A Bug's Life there. But I think A Bug's Life, just for me personally, I've loved it since I saw it. So
A Bug's Life has a lot of complexity that this movie does not have. And it's doing different things. They're very different movies. But I think if I was a kid and I was watching all of these movies like equally and, you know, and saw them the same amount of times and stuff, I would have liked Monsters, Inc. more than A Bug's Life. But I think as an adult, I really appreciate a lot of the more complex stuff they were doing in A Bug's Life. Monsters, Inc., it's a simple little story, love the world, but just wasn't super vibing with it.
Yeah, makes sense to me. Well, I think we have about covered it. So if you would like to hear more from us, you can find both of us individually all over the place. Derek, where can people find you and the things you're working on?
You can find me on Twitter at Derek B. Gale. You can also find me on my YouTube video essay series called Second Chance, which looks at bad or divisive media, but from a positive lens. What about you, Doug?
You can find me on Twitter at IckyBooley, IckyBooley. If you like Pokemon stuff, you can find me on a Pokemon podcast over on the Four-Eyed Radio Network called Victory Road, a Pokemon podcast where my co-host Kyle and I talk about Pokemon just as we feel like it. You can also find me talking about the books I'm reading and the games I'm playing with my friends Katie and Vicky on a podcast called Novel Gaming, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you would like more from Derek and me talking on a weekly basis, and actually more frequently than that if you are one of our patrons, You can find us both on a podcast called Walloping Web Snappers, a deep dive Spider-Man podcast where we are exploring every Spider-Man cartoon ever made. You can find that wherever you get podcasts. You can also see everything we are doing, including that and this, on our website at wallopingwebsnappers.com. And there will be a link to our Patreon there if you like what we're doing and want to support us and maybe get a little bit of extra content as well. Next time, we will be exploring, as you might predict, the next movie in the canon, which in January will be Finding Nemo. And if everything works out, I believe we'll have a guest for that one once again.
I'm really excited for the conversation that we're going to have about that one, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Me too. So we will see you then.
See ya.
And so we put that kid back where she came from, and she helped us to find a better tomorrow today.
Thank you. What a night for my mother to be in the audience, ladies and gentlemen. My mom! Thank you, Metropolis!